Blog Talk Radio.
Everyone, and welcome to the 157th edition of the Feuerstein's Fire Internet Soccer Show. I'm your host, Daniel Feuerstein. I'll give you an American perspective of our clubs, leagues, players, national team, and other fabulous moments. You can get your daily reading from me over at soccernewsday.com. And you can also listen to this program on mtrradio.com. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, come on in. Chat room is open. You can go ahead and talk amongst yourselves as much as you like. If you have a question for me, I'll try to answer it to the best of my ability as much as I can. We got a very special show today. It's not just also we're going to preview the NESL fall season that's going to start this coming Saturday on August 3rd. But before we do, in about a couple of minutes or so, we're going to have on Ian Thompson. Of course, he's the soccer observer with a brand new book out called The Summer of 67, talking about soccer in the U.S. Very, very interesting stuff about this book. Of course, Ian Thompson has been on this program before. I believe this is his first book, and I can't wait to have him on the show so we can discuss this. Very interesting stuff happening with soccer after the 1966 World Cup in England, and it was trying to come back big time in the States at that particular time after the American Soccer Leagues 1 and 2 failed. But before we get to Ian and before he calls in, congratulations to Columbus Crew fans. A brand new ownership group has taken over your side over at in Columbus, I understand. The Hunts will no longer be running the Columbus Crew. And congratulations to all Columbus Crew supporters. You got a brand new ownership group that's going to keep the club over in Columbus, Ohio, at Crew Stadium. We'll see what else happens, but let me just say this. Once again, very happy for Columbus fans. Pre-Court Sports Ventures will now become the new ownership group of the Columbus Crew. Thank you very much to the Hunt family. We know that their father, Lamar, was a big component to start the soccer-specific stadium craze, and he has done a fantastic job, the Hunt's family as well. But joining me now, congratulations to this first book. Of course, he is the soccer observer, and it is Ian Thompson. Ian, welcome back to the show, and congratulations on your first book. Of course, it's available on Amazon.com, which I have my copy through Amazon.com, but I understand it'll be out in print version soon.
Hi, Daniel. Yeah, thank you for inviting me back onto the show. The print version is also out. It's been out now for the last couple of weeks, so wonderful. you can pick that up on Amazon too. It's retailing for the recommended price is $12.99, but I noticed today that Amazon has it for about $11.24 or something. So you know how big Amazon is; they can share a dollar or two off. But yeah, you can pick it up in either version now.
Very good. I'm very happy to hear that. And yeah, how long did this book take you? Actually, I know you're obviously I know you're originally from Scotland. You lived in the New York City area for a while, and then of course you and your wife moved to West Virginia, and you were developing this book in West Virginia. How long did this take you, and did you have to take many, many trips around this great country just to get all this information?
Not too much, actually. I mean, it's amazing what you can do just from sitting in front of a computer with Google News and whatever else at your fingertips these days. I did have to take a few trips to the libraries, and I'm in Morgantown, West Virginia, so Pittsburgh is about an hour and 15 minutes away from me, so that's the big library, as well as the small one that I have locally. The whole project was about 7 months to do the writing, I would say, and that was, of course, just the initial research, and then a lot of time was trying to track down players who played in this tournament. I did end up speaking to 16 players from 8 of the 12 teams, and so it was quite tough you know, some of these old time guys, they don't have cell phones, they don't have internet, they're not computer literate. So mm-hmm. you know, there was a few delays trying to get in touch with people. And then, you know, I haven't been working on anything else. I've just sort of been focusing on this year. And so I managed to probably do most of the writing in 3 or 4 months. And then I wanted to step away and just leave it and come back to it fresh. And by the time I then got 4 or 5 editors involved to look at it too, kind of got finished with the writing just around about the end of June. But that's the easy part. Now is the difficult part, which is getting the word out. So I'm quickly finding out that's an infinitely tougher job.
Yeah, absolutely. But at least you knew that. I'm one of your great outlets to giving out the word for your book, obviously. And, you know, I don't mind telling everyone to go get it. It is obviously head over to your bookstores if you want, maybe Barnes & Noble's as well, Amazon.com for your also an ebook as well. Like I said, I already have my copy as well. And reading about everything, I have to say you did a very good job not just talking about the game of football in the United States, but, of course, the other professional sports leagues that has been going on between the times of, let's just say, from 1950 all the way to 1966, and obviously with the baseball New York Giants and the Brooklyn Dodgers moving to the West Coast, as well as, you just have to say, talking about the World Cup in 1966 also being broadcasted in the U.S., whether it be live or on tape delay, just an absolutely fantastic situation.
Yeah, I think, and I know, you know, I've been in the U.S. now for 6 years, and there's so much history of soccer in this country going back to 1894, when the first league was set up in the Northeast among baseball team owners that wanted to use their stadiums in the off-season. And so much of this history is just unknown. And I know from your perspective with the U.S. Open Cup, you're a huge supporter, a huge proponent of the U.S. Open Cup. And from league play, everyone knows about Pelé. Everyone knows the New York Cosmos. The story has been told so often now. I don't think we can get any more out of that tale. But what I found with this tournament was that this was really, 1967 was the first year of there being a national professional soccer league. And so if it wasn't for Lamar Hunt and Jack Kent Cook, who is the Los Angeles Lakers owner, and various other team owners at this point, Pelé and the New York Cosmos wouldn't have come. And I think recently as well, we saw when Phil Woosnam passed away last week, I was reading through a lot of the obituaries. And some people kind of know the history, but a lot of people don't, you know. And so, you know, Woosnam came in at that time to a rival league. And the United Soccer Association, which is the one I focus on, and the rival National Professional Soccer League, both lasted for a year and then merged in to the North American Soccer League. So it kind of gets confusing, but it for me, when I looked at this project and I started investigating this tournament, it just seemed that this was a huge gap in what I knew about American soccer history. And, you know, the reaction that I've had from people that I've spoken to since the book has come out has been like that also. You know, they say, wow, we didn't know this happened.
Exactly.
You know, it's kind of been a real pleasure for me to investigate, to research this tournament, and now to be able to tell people about it. It's just, you know, it's for me, you know, I'd heard when I was a kid, I'm from Aberdeen in Scotland. Aberdeen were my team. And so I'd had this abiding memory of Aberdeen once playing as the Washington Whips way back before I was born. And I never really investigated it too much until last year. And what triggered it was the fact that I went to RFK for the first time. And I thought, this is where Aberdeen played, or this would have been where Aberdeen played when they were the Washington Whips. And from there, I started to investigate and work out that this, you know, the first champions in North American soccer were Wolverhampton Wanderers, you know, playing under the guise of Jack Kent Cook's Los Angeles Wolves. So, you know, it was a really intriguing tale for me, and one that I just thought, when I looked at it, I thought at first it's an article, it's a series of articles, it's a long-form article, it's a short story, and it just ended up being a book once I started tracking down the old players and hearing their tales.
Oh, it's absolutely brilliant. Of course, ladies and gentlemen, we'll get to the NASL Fall Season Preview Show in a minute. We're here with Ian Thompson, the Soccer Observer, who wrote this fantastic book, Summer of 67. I got to admit, I had no idea that the Pittsburgh Steelers ownership, the Rooney family, Art Rooney, got involved in this as well. And, of course, the NASL, the original NASL, was actually fighting against this other soccer league, the National Premier National Professional Soccer League, I should say, to be the top league in the U.S. And, of course, at the time, U.S. Soccer, or at the time it was called U.S. Soccer Football Association, they had their little situations as well.
The acronyms get quite difficult, so I hope I did a reasonable enough job of trying to lay it out in that second chapter when I give the history. And it's something that repeats itself. I mean, you can look today where you have MLS going down its model and you have the North American Soccer League again going down its model. It's history repeating itself, you know, that different ownership groups have their ideas of how they want to go about things. It's one thing that I found was quite funny looking at this book is that although soccer has obviously made huge strides in the U.S., there are still some things that just have not changed. And, you know, among them were owners that maybe weren't quite sure of weren't sure of the game or how to market the game. It's some areas where teams were just playing in cavernous stadiums that had minimal crowds. And, of course, the referees were dreadful. So, you know, there are some constants even 5 decades on.
No, absolutely. And thank, you know, God say that that the situation, of course, now with Major League Soccer, even some of the lower level leagues, there are finally building stadiums that are made for the sport. Now, obviously, Seattle does fantastic with their situation, with their supporters, because, you know, they're sharing the same stadium with the NFL Seahawks. The minor league baseball stadium in Portland has now been truly converted into a football ground. I mean, those are the only two probably differences with the rest of the country, but still, gotta say that, you know, I think the sport is finally growing the right way now than it was back in the day.
Yeah, and one of the common complaints that I heard from some of the players that were involved in this tournament, and one that will resonate with American listeners, is Bobby Clark, the longstanding U.S. college coach who's still with Notre Dame. Bobby Clark played in goals for Aberdeen during this tournament, and you know, he and others echoed the sentiment that although these guys were full of passion to bring this new sport to America after watching the 1966 World Cup final, it was very much a top-down approach. You know, they knew that they didn't have good American talent, but so much was their haste to get a league up and running that they just decided, right, we'll take these foreign teams in. And it, of course, had those issues that this was a stopgap. These players weren't, you know, there was no connection between these foreigners that were coming in and the locals. And mm-hmm. all the while these games were going on, you didn't really have any plans for what there was going to be in terms of a youth structure or whatever else. And so in 1968, when they tried to continue with it, well, what turned into the first year of the North American Soccer League with local players, the standard just dropped away. And of course, by 1969, I think of the 12 teams that were in the United Soccer Association, only Lamar Hunt's Dallas Tornado remained. And so, you know, that wasn't quite a, it wasn't the most successful start when you had 11 teams falling by the wayside in the first 2 years.
Right, absolutely. And I guess finally, my question is this, and definitely I want to have you back on to discuss more about this fantastic book of yours, Ian, but finally, the way that the strides have been made now, what are the comparisons, I guess, to back then that makes you think that maybe, the country has done well in finding support of the game, but do you think it's more better now than it was back in the day because of maybe the social media, or what do you think?
That's an interesting question. I mean, if you look at it in some ways, back in 1967, the Houston Stars, that was actually a team that were the Rio State champions from Brazil called Bangu, Houston were averaging just under 20,000 per game in this first professional tournament. So, you know, that's something that many Major League Soccer teams today would be happy with. I think the main difference now is that the grassroots are there. There are enough people that are playing the game, and there are enough companies now that are getting involved and giving their backing. And so sponsorship is in place. It's not the teams are not being run on the whim of an owner who's going to pull the plug if he's making losses. Whereas, of course, back in the early days, that was the case. You had an owner who came in and thought, yeah, this new game is fantastic. This World Cup final in 66 was great. People are going to love this sport. And when in the first year or two they made losses, they just decided to bail out. And invariably, the owners in those days were also the owner of a baseball team or a football team or a basketball team and had multiple other business interests. And so soccer was really just an insignificant part of their portfolio. Now it's, you know, the game has a bigger profile, so it's not just a throwaway piece that they're just sort of dallying with.
Absolutely. Ian, thank you very much. Enjoy the rest of your night. And once again, everyone, you go to Amazon.com. You can go to your bookstores. The Summer of 67 by Ian Thompson. Ian, thank you and have a good night.
Thank you, Daniel.
And that's the Soccer Observer. And now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time to come on and do what you want to hear. And that is, of course, the start of our NASL fall season preview show. And first of all, before we get underway, I just want to say thank you to two important people that made everything wonderful, not just for these past preview shows, as well as NASL Championship, the Soccer Bowl Championship previews as well. You know, everyone up in Minnesota knows about Brian Korstad, and he is officially done. He's going in as a fan now. He's done with his reporting days, and I just want to thank Brian Korstad for being a part of this show. I also want to thank my good friend Carter Krishnar, who was also a part of the NASL when it was making a return. And, you know, I just really, really hope those guys do very well. Me right now, from the Atlanta Silverbacks, Neil Malone, from taking over for Brian Korstad is Mr. John Mafaller. From the local Minnesota newspaper. I'll ask him about where he writes on Minnesota United in a minute. Of course, Peter Brown, Ultras Alive. We have, of course, James Hope, San Antonio, the Crocketeers, follow the Scorpions. We also have, for the first time, I'm very glad we finally have an FC Edmonton guy on the show. Steve Sandor is the color analyst for FC Edmonton on Rogers Sportsnet West, I believe. My good friend Cesar Diaz from Latino Sports, he'll be covering the New York Cosmos. We also have on for Garrett Tozer, we have Jake Sillick, the sports freak. Of course, my good friend Neil Morris from The Independent down in Raleigh, Durham, and Cary, North Carolina. And we got a full house. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being on the show. And let's start off with Atlanta. And Neil, I'd like to apologize because I did pick the Silverbacks to finish last in the spring season, and you come up roses winning the spring season. Congratulations.
No, I appreciate that, Daniel. No, it seems like just yesterday we were on the show previewing the spring season action, and yeah, I think it was pretty much not a consensus across the board, but the vast majority were kind of, you know, think it was going to be the same old sort of losing story in Atlanta. And it looks like my optimism ended up shining through. The team had a great, spring season campaign. Obviously won it in very exciting fashion on the final night, thanks to some help from the San Antonio Scorpions as well. But, you know, since I've been with the club, and this is my third season with the club, and their third season in the NASL, I've never seen anything like the camaraderie that the team has, the belief that the players have in the coach, Brian Haynes, and some of the crowds that we're getting and the fan support. It's kind of running on all cylinders right now for the Silverbacks, and it's been a fun time for us.
Absolutely, and of course the summer window is going on right now. Has the Silverbacks brought in anybody to upgrade this team for the fall season, or it's just basically the same roster?
Well, I think the good news is when you have a solid season and have a good group of guys, come together and play well, and then you really don't lose too many people, you know, in between seasons, the answer is that you don't necessarily need to add too many pieces. The club lost, defender Mark Bloom to Toronto FC on loan, but that was a move that the club was not prepared to, prevent Mark from doing, give him the opportunity to go further his career at the highest level here in America, or I guess Canada in that case. And then Ruben Luna moved on to some opportunities over in France. But other than that, we have everybody intact. We will be announcing three more player signings, possibly four, later this week, as well as releasing one player. So there's still a little bit of moving and shaking to be done from the player standpoint. But I think in terms of, those signings, it'll be smaller pieces. And I think really, the same sort of, starting 11 and same sort of contributors you saw during the spring season championship campaign, you'll see, in action primarily this fall as well.
Absolutely. Let's go over now to these teams that are going after the Atlanta Silverbacks or at least attempting to be that opponent in the NASL Soccer Bowl, which will be later on in this year in November. Let's start off with FC Edmonton, of course, with Mr. Steven Sandor. Steven, thank you for being the representative from FC Edmonton. And, of course, not really I don't know if it was a great year or at least it was a decent season. Colin Miller, of course, was on national team duty during the Gold Cup. But how do you see this FC Edmonton side now that he's back full-time, that Canada now has a permanent head coach?
Well, he didn't really miss any FC Edmonton games, and I think we need to stress the Canada gig was the part-time gig. He was, interim coach when he had time, when the NASL schedule would allow. But I'd have to judge the FC Edmonton season, considering where this team was last year, where, the highest spending team in the league by a mile and the worst finish. And, if there was ever a team that didn't give you bang for the buck, it was Edmonton last year where you had, players who were making serious coin and a real budget drain, the highest paid coach in the league in Harry Sinkgraven, and then finishing dead last in the league. Obviously, not finishing last was the first goal. And, being third up from the bottom is actually a significant improvement. On field, the team has improved significantly under Colin, and it's now under a budget, which is something new for Edmonton for the last 2 years. It really has been sort of a little bit out of control, and now it's all been reined in. And, the owner wants to see some, Tom Fath wants to see some more results and do it in a way that's more rational now. I think they tried to spend their way into to competitiveness, and it just doesn't work at this level. And they need to build a cohesive unit. Really, where they finished with the best defensive record in the league, the fewest goals against, again, a tribute to I think the work that Colin's done. I think Albert Watson, if there was a newcomer of the year in this league, he'd be up there in the top three. I think right now he's the best central defender in the league, period. He's a big reason. He was hurt for the first month of the year. He hurt his knee in training camp. But when he came in, I don't think there's a better central defender in NASL. And you're hearing other coaches say it, too, once they've seen him play. The Northern Irish international has just been fantastic for Edmonton. And those three Linfield guys they brought in Garrett Watson and Daryl Fordyce, who started rounding into form at the end of the spring season, they've had a real impact. And this team is better. They're not championship standard yet. They're not at that top tier yet, but they certainly are better than they were last year, and certainly goals for is still the biggest problem. But at the same time, they did finish plus one on goal difference. So there are a lot of positive signs. Really, considering all the draws this team had this year, they know if they could find four or five more goals. If they would have found four or five more goals this year, they would have been right up there with Atlanta and Carolina, but they don't have those goal scorers yet. And despite their search to find a guy in this off season, they're really struggling to find guys. I know Colin's been talking to about five MLS teams about loans. Some of the guys they've targeted, there have been problems with the MLS team having injury crises and them not being able to loan out guys. They were planning to loan to Edmonton. There was one guy that they had looked at, and they'd been targeting a guy by the name of Caleb Clark, Canadian under a 20 player. that the Whitecaps had, and he's been, you know, signed to the Whitecaps roster, but instead he was now loaned out to the German side Augsburg. So those are options that just aren't happening. They do have a Canadian striker in camp named Anthony Adour, who has a really good scoring record in Asia, in like Singapore and Thailand. His cousin Kevin George plays for the Columbus Crew, and he's now in camp, and he's looking to maybe find a spot. But they really need to find that dynamic player that can really create a goal or nothing at the forward level, and that would make all the difference. Really, that the midfield has been sorted out. The defense is the best in the league, as I said. And honestly, I think with Lance Parker and John Smits in goal, you have a fantastic 1A and 1B combination in goal. So really, they're solid on the back end. It's that front end that's such a problem. But, you know, everyone looks for a striker.
Absolutely. And you're saying you're hoping for loan deals. Have they ever gone into the summer window for a transfer for FC Edmonton or not yet?
No, there's going to be a player that's going to be announced on Thursday, I believe. He's supposed to get here, but it's a Canadian player who's, you know, a developmental guy as well. My understanding, not a guy who's going to be an everyday starting 11 guy right off the bat. Definitely not for the first weekend in Carolina. So I don't see a starting 11 that's much different in Carolina than you would have seen at the end of the year in the last game of the spring season against Minnesota. The big addition will come a week or two from now when Wes Knight comes back from his broken foot. He probably would have been ahead earlier, but the Canadian healthcare system, his doctor went on vacation, and you can't have anyone but your surgeon sign off for you. So he actually has to wait to get that signature. Believe it or not, that's the way it works. So his foot's actually okay, but it hasn't been green lighted to be back on the field because his doctor hasn't signed off. And as you know, there's all sorts of complications with club rules and insurance and such if you don't actually have the doctor's signature on the piece of paper. So he's actually really frustrated sitting on the sidelines waiting because he feels fine. He's ready to go. And that'll be a big addition again, coming back, a player they expected to be a big impact player for them and actually had a really solid first couple of games for them until he broke his foot in Minnesota.
That's really terrible. Let's hope FC Edmonton has a good year this year, and we're going to move on. Of course, we're going to go to the new kid on the block here, covering his Minnesota United on this program, and of course, John Mathaler taking over Brian Korstad and Neil Morris. You will treat him with kid gloves. No hitting below the belt, Carolina.
Well, we'll see if he behaves himself.
I promise nothing.
Here we go. Mr. Mathaler, thank you very much for coming on the program. Welcome. Obviously, Minnesota United, they're a former NASL champion in the league. And, of course, they finished up around sixth place in the spring season. What does Manny Lagos need to do to make Minnesota a better side for this year, for this upcoming fall season?
Well, I think one of the things that Minnesota really struggled with in the spring was sort of the culture change between the last few years and this year, between being sort of the underdog team with no money, the league-owned team that was fighting uphill, to becoming a team that actually had some money to spend and brought some guys in and had to sort of deal with that culture change of having new guys who hadn't been around and having guys who had personalities that maybe didn't fit into the locker room. It was a little less like, you know, sort of your college drama group and more like an actual professional thing going on. And so I think they really struggled to try to get everybody on the same page. And I think the main thing that they're going to have to do in the fall is to try to get everybody pulling in the same direction more than anything. And it'll be difficult because they've had some new guys come in this summer as well.
Absolutely. Are there any targets for Minnesota for the upcoming fall season? Anyone that's particular that you've heard about for this upcoming season?
Sure. They brought in two guys on loan from Montreal, Callum Malice, who's actually a local guy from the Twin Cities area here, and Sinisha Ubiparapovic, both of them are midfielders for Montreal. Ubi Parapovic was actually on loan for one game with the old Minnesota Thunder about 6 years ago, and he scored a goal. So assuming he keeps up that record, I think it'd be a real success in Minnesota. They also traded Carolina. They traded Brian Arga as the Carolina for Floyd Franks, sort of in a in a swap of two guys who weren't really fitting into future plans. And so we'll see what Franks brings to the midfield as well in Minnesota.
Absolutely. And, of course, you know, we'll see what Manny Lagos will do. I think he'll definitely put the screws in on the guys, and he'll definitely push Minnesota United into a possible, who knows, maybe it's a three or four-way tie for first place. We'll see what happens there. But thank you very much. And, of course, we will go to Carolina now, and Kerry and Neil Morris. And, Neil, it looked like the Railhawks were going to take the spring title, but that did not happen towards the end of that exciting season. And Colin Clark is probably not a happy camper this month of July.
And he's not alone. You know, while the Atlanta Silverbacks are planning a trophy ceremony when the Railhawks visit Atlanta next month, Railhawks fans have had to take solace in the words of Dickens to describe their spring season. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was a season of light. It was a season of darkness. It was the spring of hope. It was the winter of despair. That sort of sums up the spring season. It was a spring where the team set two new attendance records, beat two MLS teams to advance to the quarterfinals of the U.S. Open Cup, rocketed to the top of the NASL standings, and had their destiny in their hands. And then in a 10-day span, they got knocked out of the U.S. Open Cup out in Salt Lake City. They failed to seal the spring by beating Atlanta in Cary. They then, on July 4th, lose to San Antonio to get eliminated. And then the only international friendly they had scheduled for the midseason break gets canceled because of a volcano eruption in Mexico. So that kind of sums up the back and forth of the Railhawks season. You know, the Railhawks, you know, were hoping that they would come out re-energized for the fall, and they may. You know, my question is going to be, and you know, as my illustration just showed, you know, small little things can tip the scales, and things can go from feast to famine in a heartbeat. And I think Carolina's biggest challenge, frankly, is going to be recovering from the gut punch of the end of the spring. Momentum has been severed, and it's going to be interesting to see whether they can ratchet that back up again. And I'm quite serious in that. As far as improving the team over the months, I'll say this: Colin Clark has not stood pat. Most of the revamping over the month break has been in the midfield, and Carolina has a heck of a midfield stable now. I've got to give them credit. I mean, it was pretty good to start with, but a combination of acquisitions and some folks getting healthy has resulted in a midfield stable that now includes Brian Shriver, who's technically a midfielder but a quasi-forward, T. Cipollone, Austin Deleuze, and Cesar Elizondo in the attacking positions. And now in midfield, you've got Brian Arguez coming in, along with Nick Millington, Brainier Ortiz, who's missed the whole spring but was a really good young box-to-box guy last year, and now Enzo Martinez is coming back on loan for the rest of the season from Real Salt Lake. So that's a heck of a midfield. Now, where's the problem? Well, it sounds a little ironic for a team that led the league in scoring to bemoan the lack of a pure ball striker, but that's what they don't have. Zach Schalowski and Brian Ackley just simply haven't gotten the job done, and the team was hoping that Nick Adlery would finally be over his knee problems and be healthy for the fall. That is looking increasingly unlikely. He may be done, in fact. So I know that the team is scurrying to try to maybe find someone on loan, or just hope that the Railhawks can all do what they always do, which is find enough goals from their attacking midfielders, which they do pretty well.
Wow.
So you know, I think, you know, they brought in Martinez, they brought in Arguez, who Colin Clark has always liked Brian Arguez and tried to sign him in the preseason, but Minnesota outspent him, and then when things went south there, he decided to cut bait with Floyd Franks, who was the team captain. and bring Arguez in. So it's going to be interesting. Carolina's not going to be short on talent, and if they can stay healthy, and mainly if T. Schipollone can stay healthy, they're going to be at the top of the heap again. But I just wonder if they can manage to get the band back together again.
Well, we'll see what happens in this fall season. And as we move on forward, of course, the team that almost came out of nowhere, of course, facing the Carolina RailHawks at home at the last moment, San Antonio Scorpions, James Hope of the Crocketeers. And James, that must have been, first of all, it's great to have your own stadium, but unfortunately it was a bad start in the spring, but yet somehow it turned around and you nearly just snuck in into that top spot.
We were right there. We were right there. We'd be the hottest team in the league the last five. We were five games without a defeat. Going into the final game against Carolina, we knew it was an uphill battle. We needed three goals, and we needed Atlanta to lose. And, well, while it didn't happen, the momentum is really in our favor for the fall season. It's been a great offseason for the San Antonio Scorpions. They had three solid friendlies that they played. They played Dorados of Mexico, Oklahoma City FC, and also played Tigres from Mexico. While it made it a great offseason for us, and we've also picked up three new forwards that I think are going to be very interesting, two of which I've seen already and pretty impressed with. Fabrice Noel, the former Haitian national, got some time near the end of the season and showed sparks of greatness. We also picked up a Polish national, Tomasz Zarowski. He's a 6'3 forward. Like a Pablo Campos type player, has definitely been impressive in practice. And then a Spaniard who's been shuffling around between the Spanish Premier and B League is Borja Ribiato, who I think could make a big push. So when it comes to forwards next year, we're certainly going to be able to have a plethora of people to work with. And then, you know, it doesn't hurt to always have a player like Hans Dennison playing that withdrawn forward position. So I think it's going to be offensively, we may see a lot more goals this spring season.
And it sounds like Tim Hankinson is also going to remain for the spring season. For the fall season as well. I mean, I think this is a great coaching job when you start off down and out, but then you have those last 5 to 6 games of that spring season to catapult San Antonio into a third place finish. I think he deserves to stay on as the fall season, as well as hopefully for next year.
I do, too. I mean, Hankinson really does have just a great amount of knowledge and his ability to go after players and take risks. We picked up, five Eastern Europeans, and three of them were a bust for us. And there was a little bit of how they worked in and just didn't work for us. However, I applaud him for being able to go after these players. You know, one of the things he had spoke about is that with the NASL and with the USL Pro as well, we kept rehashing the same players over and over again, not bringing any new talent into the league. And so what Hankinson has done is he's looked around across the leagues and said, you know, we're going to take some risk on some players, and that's why you're seeing some of these foreign nationals that we're bringing in that I think are going to give a spark to our team and actually to the league itself.
Absolutely. It's great to hear, and good luck this year in the fall. And now we move on to the state of Florida.
One more thing. There is one thing that I think that is worth noting today is Brian Jordan has left the team. Brian, as you know, who played for the he left this morning. He was announced this morning. He's decided to try his wares in Germany. And he's suffering through lots of injuries. And so he has mutually bought out his contract, and he will be traveling basically the German fourth division, trying to catch on to a squad. I think he just wanted to move on and maybe there was a little bit of how much time he was going to get on this squad now, because things have been going well, especially at the midfield. One of the local guys here, midfielder Sean Arters, has been showing well in practices and in some of these scrimmages, and I think Brian was kind of thinking that his time may have been numbered and he wanted to take another shot someplace else. And so we wish Brian a lot of luck, but I penciled him in as being really one of the stars of this league.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that, James, and good luck with the Scorpions this upcoming fall season. And now, as I was about to say, we're going to move to the state of Florida, and first we're going to go to the Tampa Bay Rowdies. Jake Sillick, the sports freak, of course. Garrett Tozer is taking his bar exam tonight and tomorrow, or is it today and yesterday? So If any of the mob players gets thrown into the clink, they have a lawyer in the group now. So, no, I'm just joking. But, real quick, though, Jake, before we talk about the Rowdies, for some of you that are not familiar, Jake is actually originally – he lives in Jacksonville. And, of course, the NASL just approved Jacksonville, Florida in the 2015 expansion. Congratulations, Jake. I know you're going to be done once with Tampa once Jacksonville comes in. I know everyone's happy for you. It's a great day in Jacksonville, to be honest.
It's incredible. We have absolutely great support for soccer. We held a watch party on Sunday at Everbank for the Gold Cup final. We had upwards of about 800 people show up, and it completely blew everybody's expectations, blew the owner's expectation, all Sunshine Soccer Group, all of City Jacksonville people that were there in the city government. They, you know, thought that there maybe a couple hundred people show up. They actually ran out of food and drinks for these people to watch the game, but everybody had a good time regardless. It's great. We've got the supporters group moving, First Coast Elite, kind of getting that going, figuring out what we're going to do with that. What's going to be our thing? You know, what's our swagger? You know.
Well,
get me on that.
Well, don't worry. We'll get you on that later on as the years go by. But anyway, let's talk about the Rowdies last year. They finished fourth in the spring season. Obviously, at the time, they were defending Soccer Bowl champions. They still have an opportunity to get back into the Soccer Bowl if they win the fall season schedule. But still, though, what were the problems you saw from the Rowdies in the spring season that you think should be able to change for the fall?
I was calling the whole entire season bizarre Rowdies, because for a team that normally has played so well at home over last season in 2012 and even in 2011, for some reason, it was the complete flip side in the spring season, where we went four wins on the road, but could only win one home game in the league, and that was the last game of the year against Fort Lauderdale Strikers. We could not get a win at home to save us, and that's what inevitably did us in for the spring season, was that we could not perform well at home.
Wow. That's really crazy. What has Ricky Hill done for transfers for the spring season to bolster this roster? Is it still the same players that you have from the spring, or did he bring in someone new?
The focus for this month off has been just to get the players we currently have healthy. We did have a lot of injuries going through. Carl Court was injured for a lot of it. Mike Ambersley was injured for a lot of it. We just had a lot of our forwards and midfielders, defenders. Draven Washington was injured for quite a bit of it. That's what's the focus been for this month, is just to get everybody healthy and everybody ready for the fall season. We did play scrimmages against ourselves and a closed door scrimmage against the local MPSL team, the Tampa Marauders, which was a 4-1 victory. And it seems as though everybody is now finally healthy. So going into the fall, we're finally going to have a healthy squad, and things should be looking up for the fall season in that respect. But no moves all whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, listen, good luck with the fall season. We'll see what happens, and finally have a balanced schedule here as we get ready for the fall season. Of course, the team that finished dead last, and I hate to use the term, but it is true, dead last, unfortunately. Peter Brown from the Ultras Alive Show, Fort Lauderdale Strikers supporter. Peter, it probably was one of the most disappointing seasons the Strikers have had since making a return in the professional soccer ranks in the U.S. What was it that led to a very bad spring season with the Strikers?
Well, it can't get any worse, right? So for this upcoming season. But everybody is throughout this whole show has been complaining about injuries and all that. And that, I think, really was a big part of the Strikers situation, is they had a ton of injuries, but so does everybody else. You know, they had a low payroll, but look, the lowest payroll won the league. So we can't use that excuse anymore, apparently. And, but, you know, made a coaching change. You know, when everything stops working, and we heard that the locker room was split and fractured, it's time to find a new coach. So Daryl Shore was finally shipped out, made a lot of fans happy. We brought in Günther Kronsteiner from Austria, and hopefully he can turn it around, but he hasn't had much time to do a whole lot. We had him on our show, and he had mentioned that, you know, he likes to play with three forwards. He wants to play very attacking, but he doesn't have the players. He has one forward in his mind. So we'll see what he can do with the little bit that they have.
Has he delved into the summer window to try and bring in some more strikers to at least get his tactics and formations to where he wants it to be?
Well, we haven't brought in any strikers, so the strikers don't have strikers still. But they've brought in three players on loan from MLS. Richard Sanchez, goalkeeper for SC Dallas. I have a feeling he'll be starting. And Kenny Walker from midfielder from Galaxy, and Brian Gall from Galaxy, a tall defender. All three of those on loan. And I hear word that there could be a fourth MLS player coming on loan. I don't know who that might be, but and then you know, they've also been trying to bring in old striker Paulo Jr., who was under contract with Real Salt Lake. I'm not sure where they're at with that, but I know he, as of spring season, he was still under contract with Salt Lake, but he was here and he was training with the Strikers, so they want to bring him in, and we all know how well he played in the NASL in the past. So they've done a few, you know, brought in a few players. Don't know if any will, you know, be any good. But and a lot of it has to do with if we can get David Foley back to health. I know he missed at least one day of practice this week with the doctor. So I'm not sure how if he'll be in the starting lineup or not this weekend. But, you know, it's just a matter of getting healthy. And he's going to have to tinker throughout the entire season. I'm hoping for a better finish than last.
Mm-hmm, obviously. I mean, you would say what, maybe mid-table?
I think that'd be a success. I mean, I can't come on here saying, "Hey, we're going to finish him first." I don't see that with the players. If, you know, if he didn't make wholesale changes, you know, and we finished last, mm-hmm. You can't expect a big change. Even though we weren't really blown out of many games, we were competitive in most of the games except for the last two. But you know, he hasn't had time to really change the team. So I think he'll end up tinkering throughout the year, and hopefully we'll see new players come in little by little throughout the year. This year, I think, is really the time for him to get ready for next year, unfortunately.
Absolutely. Unfortunately. But that's the way it goes sometimes. All right,
it
Pierre,
does.
Thank you very much. Last but not least, of course, the team that's going to come back, just like the Strikers and the Rowdies came back in the North American Soccer League. The real return of the New York Cosmos are now in the North American Soccer League. They'll be playing over in Hofstra University out in Long Island at the former football stadium, Shewart Stadium, of course. My good friend over there from Latino Sports in Cesar Diaz. Cesar, last but not least, but still, personally for me, I don't care what anyone says. I think having the Cosmos returning in American soccer, it's a good day, I think, for everyone in the U.S.
Absolutely. I agree. Thank you for having me on the show. But, you know, I do have a feeling a lot of Cosmo supporters are going to be disappointed and get a rude wake-up call because, I mean, I love the North American Soccer League. I mean, it's the first league I remembered. It's the reason why I love the Cosmos. And there's a lot of great competition there. And I just, you know, I'm curious to see because, you know, at this point, though, I'm not interested in the hype. I don't care who their kid sponsors are, their suppliers are at. I don't care whether One World Sports is covering them. I don't care who's doing the announcing. At this point now, it's like, you know what, put up or shut up. And, you know, and looking at the roster, let's be honest, though, as much as I love Gio's a good friend of mine, but can he coach at a professional level? That's what I want to see. I mean, looking at the roster, you got three goalkeepers, you have six defenders, you have eight midfielders, eight forwards. I'm guessing that they're going to run the 4-3-3. I could be wrong. I don't know. But at the end of the day, though, I mean, you know, I need to see, you know, I won't even consider the practice games that they have in England or even against Newton Pride a good way to gauge if this team has what it takes to win or to at least be competitive. So starting with Fort Lauderdale, I mean, you can look at the record, but you know what? This is a whole new season. It's a very the NASL is a very competitive league. And, you know, if you look at a lot of the record, a lot of the team losses, it has, you know, most of the teams played pretty well. So I'm curious to see at this point, you know, can the Cosmos actually play? Can Gio make the proper coaching changes, the substitutions. That's all I want to see right now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, I mean, it's now time to put up or shut up. I mean, look, it's great to see them making these preseason trips across the Atlantic. You went to Newtown, Connecticut to take on the USASA Region 1 side from the Connecticut Soccer Association. But you're absolutely right. All the hype is time to go away. We got to see what this team can do against some of the top talent in this league, in the second division of American soccer. And, Caesar, I guess the question is this. Is Carlos Mendez, the former Red Bull, the former MLSer, is he the captain of this squad, or is it someone else?
Don't know yet. It's funny because when Carlos signed with the team, I ended up meeting up with him in Mineola for breakfast, and we talked about it. I'm like, well, you know, are you going to be the captain? He says, you know, he told me then a few months ago he didn't know, but it looked like he was being groomed for it. So, like I said, come Saturday, we'll see.
Absolutely, and of course, you know, I know Peter Brown will probably say that he can't wait to restart the rivalry between the Strikers and the Cosmos. I know that Ralph's Mob fans can't wait to restart the rivalry between the Rowdies and the Cosmos. So it really should be a pretty good fall season. We'll see what's going to happen. And before we continue on here, I want to ask everyone on the panel and, you know, this question. Obviously, expansion is coming. Next year, you're going to have the Ottawa Fury joining FC Edmonton as the Canadian representatives. You're going to have the Indianapolis side, Indy 11, joining in. Loudoun County, Virginia, the Cavalry are coming in. Steven, I want to go to you first. Obviously, you are in the mountain time zone where Edmonton is, but doesn't it feel better to have some rivalries that are going to be close by? I'm assuming Indianapolis is not far away from you, and obviously Ottawa being within Canada, it's going to be a pretty good smooth ride heading over to Ontario province.
Well, it's not that smooth a ride. It's still, you know, it's still a good 4-hour flight from Edmonton for Ottawa, so it's not, you know, we are dealing with the second largest country in the world in terms of geographical size, and I know it's easy to say these things that it seems close, but I know when Bill Peterson was in Ottawa, the commissioner, and he made this whole thing about now you have a rival in Edmonton, and none of the supporters booed because, you know, no one sees Edmonton as a natural geographical rival. Until we get Calgary in this league, and I can't stress how important that is for the supporters here and for the league going forward in terms of getting Edmonton some regional rivals. Until you get Calgary going and you get that Battle of Alberta happening, you're really going to struggle to find that rival for Edmonton. I mean, even the Minnesota rivalry, I guess, what you call it, with the Flyover Cup, you know, it's really friendly. I mean, it's a smile and handshake thing where the supporters are on each other's message boards and things, but there's no real vitriol between Minnesota and Edmonton. And you know, I think that's one thing that Edmonton uses to its advantage. The one thing that they do have in the league, you see that every team is miserable when they come up to Clark Stadium. You know, I've never seen a team as miserable as Atlanta was. And I think even Brian Haynes talked about the halftime of the game. I think it was their worst performance of the year that they had up in Edmonton, where they got blown out and had a player sent off in the first half because they got messed up by the football lines and the keeper, Joe Nasco, touched the ball outside the box. But the fact is that this league needs to be in the Mountain Pacific time zones. And until that happens, like, it's exciting for us to see Jacksonville come in, but we're like, oh, that's another Florida team. You know, and no offense to the people from the Jacksonville side, but talking from the Edmonton fans' perspective, it's just another road trip out down to Florida into the heat, into the deep south, where it's like, we need those teams. You know, when we hear talk about Calgary, we hear talk about Winnipeg, we hear talk about Spokane, Washington. You know, those three are the ones that, you know, excite us the most, because they're the ones that will give us those regional rivalries. And if there is a Saskatoon in the future, that would be great too. But, you know, we're not sure really how hard the USSF is going to be about the 75% rule. Everyone has told me that they're really soft on that they're willing to sign waivers to get more Canadian teams in if that's what, you know, the NASL wants. I don't know if that's what they want. I know Bill is really big on Winnipeg. I mean, he lived there for a while, and, you know, he talks very strongly about Winnipeg, and there will be a bid once they sort of get this Calgary thing sorted out, if there's going to be a bid or not. But it's still, you know, expansion's exciting, but, you know, we're talking about Oklahoma City, and we're excited about that being close, and that's like 2,000 kilometers away, which is about, you know, 1,200 miles. So, you know, that's like, wow, that's close.
Absolutely, and James, you're excited too, because you can just get on the Amtrak and head up to Oklahoma City to see the Scorpions take on the Oklahoma City side in the NASL.
We're really excited about a six-hour trip. I mean, that's just fantastic. It's kind of like going to the grocery store in some parts of Texas. So it's having a team this close is a lot better than having to go 17 hours to Atlanta. So we can't wait for Oklahoma City to be in the league in 2015.
Absolutely. And, of course, I want to go to Peter about this. We already talked about Jake's part of it because he'll be taking over Jacksonville NASL for the show. But, Peter, now you have you know, you can go to Western Florida now in Tampa, St. Petersburg. You can head up Northern Florida a couple of hours, or you take Amtrak up there, whatever. But, I mean, I think that's exciting for the Strikers to have another Floridian professional club that the Strikers can go and face.
No, it's awesome. It's great. You know, it's another trip we can make, support the Strikers. And you know, what will end up really happening is Jacksonville's going to end up hating on Tampa just as much as Fort Lauderdale does. Because, you know, none of the teams in Florida really like Tampa. You know, we've got nothing against Jacksonville yet. But, I mean, even in USL Pro, Orlando City doesn't like Tampa. So, you know, we'll all commonly bond on our hatred about Tampa. But I'm excited for Jacksonville. I think it's great. It'll be fun to travel up there. And hopefully a rivalry will start.
Absolutely. We'll see what happens. But Neil Morris, obviously Carolina, you kind of have the best of both worlds. I mean, on the East Coast, you're like in the middle. You can go up to New York anytime you want. You can head on down to Atlanta, even in Florida. So you're kind of like up and down the East Coast, like right in the middle of getting to these places.
Sure. And, you know, NASL provides lots of travel money for us to do that. So that that worked out great. I suppose the real regional rival for Carolina is Atlanta, for a host of reasons. You know, it's the one that's within legitimate driving range. Although, as you would want to research, the Amtrak routes are not very amenable. And again, with it coming down to the table being Atlanta and Carolina at the end of the season, I think that's what made it even more bitter. for coming up a little bit short, you know, the Atlanta Ultras, who developed their own reputation over the spring, paid a visit to Carolina and had a good contingent for that next to last regular season match, and likewise Carolina, some of the Triangle soccer fanatics went down to Atlanta and lived to tell about it. So that was. I think that's our rivalry. Frankly, I'm holding out for a Charlotte expansion franchise. I'm not breaking any news. I have no inside information. I'm not even. I mean, no illusions by that. But that's an NASL market if I've ever seen it. And I know it's another Southeast team, Steve. But man, if you get a Charlotte team, you get a Charlotte team and get that triangle with Raleigh and Atlanta, that would be fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, gentlemen, let's start with some predictions in this fall season. Who will face the Atlanta Silverbacks in the Soccer Bowl final? We'll start off with Neil Malone. And, Neil, you can probably pick whoever you want now. I mean, I know you probably want to win the fall season, but who do you would like to see in the Soccer Bowl at Silverbacks Park?
Well, I think you know, the whole split season format brings a pretty interesting twist to this season. I mean, you know, from a Silverbacks point of view, we've already gotten, you know, our booked our place in the final, and it's one of the things that, as the PR manager and the person that writes a lot of the articles on the website have asked, you know, the players and the coaches. It's kind of, you know, Not to sort of slight their work ethic or, you know, obviously desire to win, but you ask them kind of what is there to play for. And, you know, they've told me that, you know, obviously they want to go into the Soccer Bowl in good form. Usually the team that goes into the final with the best form comes out the champion. And, you know, the team really sort of has a very unique point of view from a standpoint of they still feel like they need to prove something and go out there and show people that, you know, winning the spring season wasn't some sort of fluke. So While I think the Silverbacks will continue doing well, I think Brian Haynes will probably take advantage of, you know, getting some other guys, you know, some playing time and some experience so that by the time the Soccer Bowl does roll around, he can sort of call upon whoever he needs. So I wouldn't expect us to repeat as fall season champions. I really look at, you know, I look at the Railhawks. I think, you know, watching the teams up close in the spring season, to me, they were the most talented as a group. I know they really laid an egg a couple times on the road and didn't finish very strong, but they've got a really intriguing roster from my point of view. I don't think the Cosmos are going to win the fall season. I just I don't know why I feel that. I think there's going to be a little bit of an adjustment period there. So my front runner would be the Railhawks, and I think you got to look at Tampa, you know, Tampa Bay Rowdies and the San Antonio Scorpions as well. Scorpions finished very strongly in the spring season, and I just don't see Tampa, you know, sort of stumbling like they kind of did in the spring. So, you know, I think the Railhawks, Rowdies, Scorpions, and Cosmos will kind of all be in the mix, but I'll choose the Railhawks.
All right, Neil Morris.
I think the logical choice is Carolina. I think at their best, they were the most – well, I don't know. Atlanta played really well. I can't say that. I think they were the best team that I saw outside of Wake Med Soccer Park. Carolina, they're the logical choice. But I really do question whether they can ratchet back up the energy. I mean, it's a fickle thing. It really is. They're going to have a new team captain. They're bringing in some new guys. They've got a deep roster, but they're pivotal players. They only have a few pivotal guys that if they lose them, things can fly off the rails. And you know, Carolina's next championship will be its first. So it's hard to bank on them. I think the fashionable choice is the San Antonio Scorpions, who probably did finish the spring season playing better than anyone else, and maybe finally got their rotation down. They've got a solid defense, and if Dennison can keep up his form, and those new strikers can new forwards can find their form, they all of a sudden become a really dangerous team. But I'm not going to go with the fashionable. I'm going to go with a flyer, and I'm going to say Tampa Bay. Any team that shows that they can win reliably on the road is a team that has to be reckoned with. And the fact that they only won one at home, although that field at Al Lang is a dumpster fire, they're going to find a way to win games down there, and they have the experience to win on the road. Carolina can't win on the road. They can't, and I don't know if they have an answer of how to figure it out. Tampa can. They've got experience, and if Ambersley can get healthy and if Court is healthy, all of a sudden a very good team that only finished 3 points out of first place and has experience, championship experience, suddenly becomes very dangerous. And you know, I guess it all hinges on the health of their forwards, but, you know, and the defense finally coalesced back there. They had some troubles early, but, you know, I, with the experience they have and with the talent that they were missing that may be coming back, and the fact that they can actually win on the road, I'm going to say Tampa Bay.
All right, and now we go to Canada, and Mr. Sandor, and your pick for the fall season winner.
First off, I got to say that I sometimes find that teams, once they've had that sort of terrible loss, just as many times as they'll fall apart, they rally. And I think that Carolina has enough in itself and with talent-wise, to come back and take that fall season title. Now, even a couple of extra games will help them. I think there are going to be some wild cards in the season that are really going to affect this September-October year, especially the fact that the league – I was really surprised when I saw the schedule. Just like Edmonton normally starts off almost all of April on the road because it's too cold to play up here, I would thought that they would have, you know, kept Edmonton on the road for October, and they didn't. So what's going to be interesting is teams like Tampa, who play, I think, the second last game or last game of the year in Edmonton, are going to be playing in freezing conditions and maybe snow on the ground. And, you know, I think that really hurts them in the sense of coming up to Edmonton and having to play in October. The teams that are going to have to come up here in August are going to have the bonus or September of being in maybe decent weather in the early parts of September, August. But it, I think that part's a wild card. As I said, I think Carolina, though, has enough to in the tank, and I think they have enough depth. And as Neil was talking about, I think their midfield is good enough to compensate for maybe the lack of a true attacker. But at the same time, I think Edmonton will move up to about third. I think the fact that that defense is so good, and the fact that they were miles, you know, if you look statistically, they were far ahead in terms of goals against. I think that's going to play. And what they need to do is take care of business at home. They allowed some wins to escape them. There was a game against Carolina where they gave up a goal late. There was a game against Fort Lauderdale when Fort Lauderdale sent up a B lineup because of U.S. Open Cup, and Edmonton went down a man early and played probably their worst game of the year and lost to Fort Lauderdale. You know, the irony of these things is Fort Lauderdale was probably the best team against Edmonton this year, and Atlanta was the worst. Atlanta looked like Atlanta of last year, 2 years ago, against when they played Edmonton. I think they had their two worst games, their worst home game of the year and their worst game of the year, period, when they played Edmonton. That's just the irony of how the schedule breaks down sometimes. But I think with that defense, Edmonton will finish around third if they could take care of business at home, because really they shouldn't be giving up points at home because of the huge advantage they have with the turf, with the football lines, and with the fact it's a terrible flight for most of the teams to come up here. And I think the weather will play a huge advantage for them in the late September or in October games, that they could take care of business at home. I just don't see this team getting enough points on the road, because conversely, August in Carolina, if it's like 80, you got to understand, someone from Edmonton, that feels like 120 to you people. Like, you know, it really is like, you know, the climates are that different. And Edmonton doesn't really practice in that kind of climate. They don't work out and train in that kind of climate. And that southeast is always a killer for them. And you see that when they go down there. They really have a problem sometimes with energy and dealing with that heat. I know in Texas as well, when they played in San Antonio, they just couldn't believe how hot it was. It was like it was ungodly hot for them. And, you know, probably the guys from the Crocketeers would say, well, that's just an average Texas evening, right? And that's the kind of differences you have. But it'll play to Edmonton's advantage in September and October, and it'll be interesting to see how that climate plays a role. And it was a huge part of that decision with the 10-20-game schedule, too, for next year, because you simply couldn't have Edmonton and Ottawa starting their season in March because you would have been playing in 2-3 feet of snow. So they the league knows that they can't that basically there's only a sweet spot with the weather in Edmonton, and that I think is going to play an interesting wild card role for those teams that have to come to Edmonton in October. And it was really weird to me when I saw the schedule. I thought Edmonton would start off play 4 games at home in August to get rid of that, and then go with a road heavy schedule in October. And it just isn't working like that.
Right. Okay. So we'll see what happens, and Edmonton will finish third, and we'll go to Peter Brown in Fort Lauderdale. Your prediction, sir.
Well, no love for strikers from anybody. What's going on? nobody's expecting us to climb out of the cellar.
Well, I haven't gone yet. Relax. You won't finish last this year.
We won't finish in last. That'll be an accomplishment. I'm going to go out on a limb, like everybody else, and say Carolina. I mean, I think Carolina's you got the two Bryans back together, and Brian Shriver and Brian Arguez, who both spent time together in Fort Lauderdale. So they're back together again. That's good. And I'd pick Carolina. But, you know, when I was hearing Steve talk about FC Edmonton being how cold it is, you know, I had to look at the striker schedule, and we finish up in Edmonton in November. So that's gonna be a loss, I think, for the Strikers, because it's going to be too damn cold. But, you know, I would put my money on Carolina. But, that you know, that also means if everybody's picking Carolina, they're doomed.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
The key is don't spend the most in this league. It's the curse of Minnesota at Edmonton the year before. If you spend the most, you will finish poorly.
Just ask Minnesota.
And Edmonton the year before.
Boy, Mr. Marthali, your predictions for the winner for the fall season.
Well, it's a little hard. I think everybody so far has picked everybody in the league to win, so I'm running out of options to be somewhat different here. But I'm not going to pick Minnesota just because they struggled so much. Obviously, everybody's talked about Carolina is always good. San Antonio is real likable, if for nothing else, and they finished the spring season so strongly. It sort of proves that they have the ability to adjust on the fly, which is something that a lot of teams struggled with down the stretch. And so San Antonio sort of stands head and shoulders above there. But I wouldn't rule out New York either, just on the off chance that there's an edict from the league office and they end up getting five penalties every game and having three guys from the other team sent off just so that they can have New York in the championship game in November. So I wouldn't rule them out yet either.
Caesar, what do you think about that one? Go ahead.
Well, I'm definitely not picking the Cosmos to play it safe. But you know what, man? I'm going to go with a long shot. I'm going to pick the Fort Lauderdale Strikers. Hey.
Ah, thank you.
You know, I'm going to go with a long shot. I'm going to throw the Hail Mary, you know, because everybody's picking Carolina this, Carolina that. I love Colin Clark. He did great for the Puerto Rico Islanders, who a lot of us have forgotten about. But the reality is Carolina is just a jinx team. They don't win it when it matters. That's it. So I'm picking the Fort Lauderdale Strikers, and when they play Atlanta, you know, I look forward to my ultra scarves, because, you know, I'm calling it, man. If the Silverbacks win from last to first, it's going to happen with the Strikers. Boom.
Oh, look at that. Putting his money down. I love this. This is fantastic. Mr. Hope, your predictions for the fall.
Well, if you remember in the first one, I picked, of course, San Antonio to put a good run through there in Minnesota. But I said my dark horse was Atlanta, and they certainly were. They came out and took care of business. I really didn't see anyone who really just stood out on the team, but they got the work done. With this schedule of automatically being in the Soccer Bowl, I expect Brian to kind of take off the pedal a little bit and not start looking to bring the team back to true form until, you know, late October. So, you know, I think it's going to be between San Antonio and Carolina. We've had a great run, and I don't see it changing. And our owner is committed to bringing in players that are going to make us champions, and it's ours to lose. It's San Antonio's to lose.
All right, we'll see what happens there. And Jake, you got to beat Tampa Bay again, so go ahead, give us your Rowdies prediction as well as the fall season prediction. What do you think?
I definitely would put my money on Carolina or San Antonio as well to win the fall season. They both had great campaigns in the spring. San Antonio coming on very strong at the end, which really kind of put them out there as, hey, they're definitely going to be a favorite going into the fall. The Rowdies will be there. They have a solid team. They got good talent. So they'll be there, but I still would think that Carolina and San Antonio can get it done in the fall with the way they've been playing. So as far as that's concerned. But we'll see what the Rowdies can do. And just one last thing really about Jacksonville.
Mm-hmm.
To the rest of you guys, be careful when writing anything about Jacksonville. Steven, I know you've already kind of experienced this, but any kind of just check your facts with Jacksonville, because on Twitter we're very prideful of our city. We're very prideful of our teams that we have here in Jacksonville. And any kind of ignorance or lack of facts on Jacksonville will be dealt with swiftly. So just be very careful with that.
Uh-oh.
Jacksonville's still in Florida, right?
It is.
And Florida's still like 37 hours away
from
Michigan, right?
That, yeah, for the listeners that I had one of my followers really disparage the on my Twitter feed, really disparage the Jacksonville bid, and yeah, there was quite the firestorm when it was one of my regular readers actually.
What was funny about that, Stephen, was that he said that our housing market was absolutely terrible. Literally the next day, the Local Business Journal in Jacksonville writes an article about how we're the top rising housing market in home sales in the nation. So we just all absolutely had a laugh about it. I mean, just couldn't believe it.
Yeah, well, to be fair, it's some of the indicators, the economic indicators, don't necessarily do justice because it doesn't take in those intangibles. I mean, Edmonton's drawing now about 2,500 a game,
in a market that has the second highest average income in North America, right? So, I mean, you tie those things in and you say, well, geez, Edmonton should be, like, in terms of a size, a city of a million people that has, like, that average income. You know, you would think that it would be a gold mine to 5,000-6,000 fans a game. It isn't. There's a lot of intangibles out there that affect the market.
Daniel,
all right, I
got to
play ref.
Daniel, is it too late for me to change my pick for the 2014 fall season to Jacksonville?
probably. Well, it's supposed to be 2015,
and that's Neil Morris,
but hey,
for everyone on Twitter. That's Neil Morris for everybody on Twitter. Please, I pick Jacksonville in the fall season.
He's afraid of the everybody on Twitter.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, listen, I'm the referee here. Okay, no more politics. No more about rising house prices, lowered house prices. We're going to talk soccer, and that's the end of it. But I want to thank everybody for being on the Fall Preview Show for 2013. Good luck to your teams that you represent as well as cover. Good luck, everyone, and thank you very much for the time. I appreciate it, and talk to you guys. Whoever gets to win the final, hopefully, we'll have you guys on for the Soccer Bowl preview show that's going to happen around November. So good luck for the fall season, and hope to have you guys on during the show as the fall season commences.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, Daniel, for having us
on.
Thank you.
Thank you, Daniel. Right. Really appreciate it.
No problem at all. Thanks a lot, everyone. Of course, Stephen Sandor in Edmonton, Neil Malone in Atlanta, Neil Morris in Cary, Peter Brown in Fort Lauderdale, Jake Sillick, Tampa/Jacksonville, Cesar Diaz, New York City, Mr. John Mathaler from Minnesota, and, of course, James Hope from San Antonio. I hope I got everybody's names down. Thank you very much for being on the show. I really do appreciate it, and have a good night, everybody. Hope everyone has themselves a good night and everything else. Now, of course, we ran a little late, but of course, it's meant to do so. We're going to go to the Red Bulls Hour. What a match at Red Bull Arena last Saturday night. It was a thriller. It was a 2-1 lead for the Red Bulls at half, and then here comes Alvaro Saborillo. He scores two in the second half, plus the penalty towards the end of the first half for his hat trick. But then, of course, a penalty given to the Red Bulls late in regulation. Fabian Espíndola, who already converted an earlier penalty, got his second one of the match, converted both. 3-3 was the score. Stoppage time winner. 5 minutes of stoppage time in the second half. And then the hero of the match, it wasn't Thierry Henry. It wasn't Tim Cahill. It was subbed out around the 85th minute. It was none other than Dax McCarty, who has started off the season well and then got himself injured in a training injury for his leg. Slow coming back, but he made up for it big time with a fantastic goal, who was coming from a defensive position. Lloyd Sam brought the ball down to the end line, gave the ball back to Brandon Barklage on the near side, the ball going towards the near side touchline, and then all of a sudden, here comes Brandon Barklage with the fantastic cross still in play. Dax McCarty comes out of nowhere with a diving header, and that was the match winner in the 94th minute, the fourth minute of five added on in the second half, and it was absolutely brilliant. It's a little over 18,000 at Red Bull Arena, but it sounded like 25 when Dax McCarty got the match winner, and the New York Red Bulls maybe saving a point, dropping two, able to get the full 3 points, 7 goals in total. It was absolutely an exciting night at Red Bull Arena. We'll get to some more of that in a minute, of course, with the audio. But you got to say, with Mike Petke doing a fantastic job managing this team at home. Of course, the road situation can be a little bit so it's just basically a fantastic stuff. And you just got to say, it's just wonderful stuff at Red Bull Arena on Saturday night. And now they are in second place. They're 1 point behind Sporting Kansas City, who leads the East. So it's just wonderful stuff. And you just got to say for the Red Bulls, big 3 points. And you just got to say once again, a fantastic, fantastic big 3-point victory for the New York Red Bulls as they went out there and they did a job and they were able to get into second place, tied with Montreal on points, but only a point behind Sporting Kansas City, and they will be at Sporting Kansas City this coming Saturday night on NBC Sports Network, 6:30 p.m. Eastern, and go check your local listings for the channel number where you are. Let's go straight to the audio. Head coach Mike Petke on what was a thrilling victory for the Red Bulls.
Head coach Mike Petke. Mike, your thoughts on tonight's match today?
Great game. Just to watch. I mean, we're literally the coaches are in there saying that just unfolded like that. Thought we were very good in the first half. Thought we did exactly what we wanted to come in here. We know how they were going to play. Defensively, they pressure you to one side. They do a phenomenal job. And if you don't switch that ball quick enough, they have you. I think we did well there. We were able to get behind them and create some phenomenal stuff from Thierry, Eric, Spindola, all working together, combinations, getting forward, and defensively in the first half. We were sound. Second half, didn't start the way we wanted to. We let them dictate the pace and the pressure a bit. But then when we snapped out of it, we had some moments as well. And I didn't see the stats yet, but I'm not sure how many shots on goal they had. But I think when they scored the third goal, they couldn't have had more than 3, 4, maybe 5. If I'm completely wrong. So that's frustrating a bit. But they're a lethal team. They're a very good team.
Frank, then Franco.
Mike, I know it's a little bit of a different scenario when you're the coach, but do you remember ever playing in a game like this as a player when they went back and forth so much late in the game?
Yeah, absolutely. There's many games like that. And it's thrilling for 1 second, and it's agony the next second, and then you try to find a way. And when we went down against a team like Salt Lake, with not long to go, you know, you start figuring out what you're going to do, what approach you're going to take. And we went all out. We put another forward on. We wanted to obviously chase the game. We would set the forward defender off and put Marius Obikov on. And then once we got the goal, we decided to put him up a little higher. So it's a great game. I'm sorry. I'm a little lightheaded from all the screaming and what happened out there. So it was a great game.
Franklin and Grant.
I know it might be tough to put into words right now, but after seeing Saverio score the 2 goals and give them the lead late, I mean, what were your thoughts in that moment, and then obviously when you guys scored the PK and then the last goal?
I was very unhappy, extremely unhappy, allowing him to get those 2 goals. I think where we excel at times phenomenally is guys like Olavi Holgersson really getting a tackle and really stepping up. But you know, you see the result of what happens if you give someone like Saborio room like that and make you pay. Listen, my job is ecstasy and agony, I guess you could say, and there's no in between. So this week I'll be happy. For that moment after they scored, I was miserable. The moment we scored to tie it up, I was happier. The moment we scored to win, I was very happy. So I have 5 days till Kansas City. That's my life. But right now, I'm very proud of these guys for coming back like that and for the effort they put in.
Grant.
Sullivan made a few substitutions about midway through the second half and it looked like they were sort of in the ascendancy at that point. Can you just talk a little about your own late subs that you made?
I mean, Fabian already had a goal. I mean, Thierry's our captain. You know, any moment he could bring out the brilliance. And we need to get him more attacking players on, obviously. To bring on a Peggy, Johnny Steele, I think, worked very hard. He had some very good moments. My thought process was to get 3 forwards on there, play almost a three up top, and we decided to go there to put him on the left. Before that, Tim, early in the first half, got a knock, a very bad knock, and he fought through it, and it's one of those things that we're fighting with each other. He's telling me I better not take him off, giving me that look that I remember as a player I would do, because he wants to be involved, but then to see what the work that he puts in and him grimacing, we have to get him off. So just slide in Eric and bring Lloyd on. I thought Lloyd did some very good stuff down the wing. And then Obi Cup, we saw last week when he came into Toronto, how dangerous he could be. And we're hoping that he could sit behind the three forwards and be a bit of a spark. Didn't get much minutes, but, I went offensive. Even when we tied the game, I didn't want to settle for a tie at home. Without sacrificing losing, I wanted to be offensive-minded.
Take two more. Dan, and then Dan.
Mike, talk about Dax McCarty, obviously the big game winner. When he did pick up that knock in training, he was out for several games, but of course, has he been slowly getting back to where you think he needs to be effective for the club?
I think Dax is still coming back. I think we had a couple conversations over the last couple of weeks. He's not satisfied exactly where he's at. Neither am I, because I expect so much from him. Having said that, he's not playing terrible. I think Dax, once Dax embraces exactly what I want from him and can put that in week in, week out, that's when you might see him get to the next level, because we have high hopes for Dax. That's why we signed him to a contract, and he's a big player for his club, and he's a very accountable player, so he knows he's just not where he wants to be, but he's playing okay for us, and that goal right there hopefully boosts his confidence.
Last one here.
Coach, there are over 40 fouls in the match, and when you see a game get that physical, what's your message to the team?
Be smart. You know, the last thing you want is someone to get ejected. I think there was a lot of fouls called today. I think there was some missed. I think there were some moments, but overall, I don't know what the foul stat was, if any team was overly more fouled or not, or if it was kind of even, but the whistle blew a lot tonight, and you have to adapt to that type of game, you know? You have to you have to expect that, you know, she's going to start throwing cards out, and I think there was a bunch of cards tonight, so I like a physical game, so I don't know, it worked in our favor tonight.
Thank you very much, Rebels Long. Thank you.
And that's Mike Petke on the match against Real Salt Lake. Great match, absolutely fantastic match, and the one thing, unfortunately, in this match that wasn't so great is the prognosis of Tim Cahill. He has a PCL tear inside his left knee. Thankfully, it doesn't need surgery, but unfortunately, he'll be out 3 to 4 weeks rehabbing it and coming back. He'll miss this coming Saturday's game against on the road at Sporting Kansas City. Forget about the All-Star game. I take no credence anymore into the All-Star game. It's just a cash grab. I don't really count it anymore. He'll miss at Columbus. He'll miss home against Philadelphia. And then he'll miss the road game at Chivas USA. So that's just really, really terrible news. Thankfully, no surgery. So it's not that bad, but still it's not that great either. And here's Tim Cahill on what happened with the tackle by from the RSL player. I forgot who it is now. Yordani. Gabriel, yeah, Alvarez. Yordani Alvarez. He's the one who created the injury. So here's Tim Cahill on his situation. And don't forget, scored a great goal after he got studded into, great goal to get it 1-0 on a free kick from Thierry Henry. Left wide open, and he headed it past Jeff Antonella for that first goal of the match. But still, here's the audio for Tim Cahill.
Watch the replay.
Yeah.
It's probably the worst tackle I've ever had in my life in 17
really?
Years. Worst tackle. But
okay.
Happens in football. Suppose you've got to take it literally on the knee and get on with it. You know? Okay.
Did you think that you were done for the game, or there was no way in the world? I mean, look at the way it's falling right now. It's...
No. Honestly, now, I just watched it now with... I don't even know how I got up, but, you know, adrenaline rushes through your body. Such a big game, so much importance on it. And it happens, you know. I think, I took a nasty knock in the first half. one of their players takes a little bit of a knock in the second half,
mm-hmm.
and Alave gets a yellow card because the coach asked for a yellow card and he gets one. You know, it happens in football, and the thing is, it's disappointing that you can't shake hands and get on with it because, you know, in my experience in football, the intensity is where you play, and that's it. So, hey, it needs no explanation.
Okay. How redeeming was it that you were able to get a goal 6 minutes later after you got taken out?
Yeah, I think for me, it's all about playing, and I said I wanted to get as many minutes under my belt when I play in this league because you want to be fit and you always want to be competing against the best teams, and they are one of the best. You know, I watched them yesterday for an hour after training. You know, footballing wise, they're brilliant. They're one of the most complete teams I've seen in the league. That's my first opportunity to play against them, so you know, they're a good football team, a very good football team, so a lot of credit to them.
Such a physical match against Real Salt Lake here. Do you feel like the referee or the officiating staff may have let this one go away a little bit?
Yeah, what about last week when I scored and got disallowed? When it was a goal. What about this week? It speaks for itself. You know, there's not much you can say. Anyone who watched the game can make their own assumptions of what they think about the referee. But for us, like I always say to the players, just get on with it. Play. People make mistakes, people might not make mistakes, but the main thing is for our desire to want to win was the reason why we come out on top. You know, we made a few mistakes, but you know, collectively as a team, you take responsibility. And you know, this is the best thing about this team, we're starting to really grow together. And you know, it just felt amazing when the Ducks scored that header. Everyone, I wasn't even on the pitch, but the fans were brilliant. And it's those special moments in football that make it such a great game.
In Toronto,
you had a similar situation where you gave up a late goal and you scored a late win. Today, again, you give up a late goal back and take a late win. What does it say about team's character at this point in the season?
This team's got a lot of character, especially if we'd lost this game today. I think you guys would have thrown the kitchen sink at us. So, and there's a lot of pressure going into the game against Kansas City, because that's a massive game as well. But you know, overall, when you look at it, it's just such a great game to be a part of. You know, I don't even know when I got the knock, but I just didn't want to miss the game. They're the best team in the league, one of the best teams, and you don't want to miss games like that. So, you know, now you look at it, and it's all worth it in the end. So.
And that is Tim Cahill, of course, talking about what happened. Very, very nasty injury. Yordani Alvarez did get booked, but the way, if you saw it, that definitely should have been a red card. That definitely should have been done because that was absolutely horrible. Obviously, you know, it was more reckless than intentional, but still. That should have been a red card. That should have been sending off. And now hopefully we'll see what's going to happen in these next couple of games. Tim Cahill suffers that terrible injury. Let's keep on going with the audio. Of course, the man who had the match winner in Dax McCarty. What a game. What a fantastic finish by him. Diving header. He does it like Cahill, and he gets the winner. And this is Dax McCarty.
Today's sports game, we'll just talk about your emotions and feelings afterwards.
Oh, man. That's a crazy one. It's one of the craziest games I've ever been a part of in MLS, my career, ever, basically. You go from literally shooting yourself in the foot, asking yourself how you let them back in the game. I thought, for the most part, first half completely dominated. To go in, giving up a goal with 3 minutes left, whatever it is, it's a gut punch. It really is. It's a tough one to take, and I think we recovered okay. And I promise you, other than their goal and the Morales free kick, I can't remember our keeper having to make a save. That's a great performance against a team like Salt Lake. They score two goals off two shots in the second half, and you're sitting there asking yourself how this is possible. But we got character. We have a lot of character. Fabian was fantastic tonight. I thought both penalties were very, very justified. That's how what you get for being aggressive, and then the game winner. I mean, you can't really write it up any better than that. It's a great feeling, and
I don't know what it is. I always seem to score headers. I don't know. I don't know why. It's very strange.
What's your thought process at 3-3?
Well, it's funny. Mike's probably really happy with me right now, but I don't think he's too happy when I was running into the box, because after the third goal, he said, "Listen, I know we're at home, but sit in front of the back four. We can't give up another goal. We have to be smart about this." And I saw Eric Alexander sitting a little bit when the ball was kind of getting worked out wide. I thought, "Yeah, I'll give it a go. Why not? Only a couple minutes left." And it was a great ball by Brandon. What can you say? Brandon's been playing some great service. And honestly, I thought I saw Peggy, and I thought he was about to kick me in the face. But figured I'd just channel my inner Tim Cahill and stick my head where it probably didn't belong. And luckily, you get good contact, you close your eyes, and good things happen. So it feels good. We needed it. It's a big, big, big result for us.
I was going to ask you, he's giving you pointers on how to deliver a perfect header?
No, you know, me and him aren't the biggest guys in the world, but we're decent in the air. You know, you can take a lot from Timmy in the air. He's got fantastic timing. And that ball, maybe it was better suited to a volley, but I figured, you know, with the header, have a better chance of getting it on frame. So, yeah, it's a great feeling. I'm just glad I didn't have a yellow card before I took my shirt off.
What were your immediate thoughts? Obviously, you had the ball and then just look up and see that it actually hit the back of the net.
Well, my immediate thought was I'd never heard Red Bull Arena that loud before. It was unbelievable. What a great feeling. And my immediate thought was just that this is a game that only happens once every couple years in MLS. You don't get many games where it's that back and forth, that wide open, with as many, you know, good opportunities that in the last 10 minutes. It felt like kind of a half-court game. They would come down at us, we'd go back at them, and I think for us, it got a little bit more stretched than we would have liked. I was actually I was mad at myself. I could have done better on Sabaria's third goal. You know, you think you hold him up, and the guy has a fantastic finish. I mean, you got to give him credit. But I thought I could have done better, so I was a little mad at myself. And you know, when you score the game winner in the 90 whatever minute, I mean, you feel like a little bit of redemption. So I'm just glad I was there at the right time.
I can say this: you're a veteran of this league. I mean, yeah. You've probably read about or been a part of some of these crazy, wacky games that happens in this league. Is there one that comes to mind? That were either for DC or Dallas or
absolutely.
Here.
There's one that comes to mind, but it wasn't an MLS game. It was actually a game in Superliga when we were playing at LA Galaxy. It felt exactly like that. I think the game ended up 6-5 or something like that for LA, and it was like one of those games where you're sitting there like thinking, man, I don't know why we get paid to play defense. But yeah, it's just one of those games that you have to remember in your career. I mean, it's one of those moments that, you know, I'll take with me. And I think rather than, you know, feeling good about the goal, I just feel good that we got a win against the best team in the league. Look, let's be honest, they're missing, you know, 3 or 4 very big players for them. And, you know, we were coming off a disappointing result in Toronto. So both teams were motivated to get a good result tonight. And this result can do a lot for a team. This can define a season, you know. With this resilience, this character that we have, we know that against the best team in the league, we came back from a goal down with 7-8 minutes to play. So it's a result that can kind of galvanize you, and it's a result that can kind of push you forward and make you really realize that, you know, we can do special things this year.
And that's Dax McCarty talking about the match winner. Absolutely fantastic stuff from him, and just very happy to see him getting some positives out there. Of course, we talked about Tim Cahill earlier with the injury, and sounds like Eric Alexander, who's normally central in the midfield, is playing the right wing, being moved back centrally, and it sounds like Lloyd Sam's going to go on the right side here as a start for a couple of games. So we'll see what happens. It's going to be tough without Tim Cahill, obviously, but I think we'll see. I have a funny feeling that we will see what's going to happen with how Mike Pecky's going to set up the starting 11, and then we'll see what happens if whoever is going to come on as a substitute. We'll see what happens the next couple of matches. But right now, in the month of August, it's going to be tough. It's going to be very, very tough. We'll see what happens as we move on. Of course, we go to Fabian Espíndola. He's a part of Real Salt Lake. Ever since he came to Major League Soccer, you know, obviously he wants to do well for his new side. And, of course, he's got a lot of respect for some of the old teammates that he has back over in Salt Lake, including, of course, Jaimison Olave, Johnny Steele, you know, those guys. But it was Espíndola that did a fantastic job converting the two penalties that the Red Bulls got, even though they did cough up one, and that was converted by Saborío. But once again, great job by Fabian Espíndola to convert, and here's his audio right now.
Talk about scoring two goals against your former team, how big of a game it was for you. And
I mean, it's always important to score, you know, to help the team. And then it is special against those guys. I have a lot of care for those guys, so that's what I have to say.
You and Heimisen, of course, obviously waiting for this time to come because it's been such a long time. You've been with Salt Lake for many, many special moments. How good did it feel to actually convert those two penalties for yourself?
Like I said, it was good, no, because it was against them, just because I did my job. That's all.
And what does it mean to face, obviously you faced him in practice many times, Saborío, that he gets the hat trick. What type of player has he been to that club that you've known for so long?
But he's
like a strong player. He got a hat trick tonight against him.
Yeah, he's
you know him very well.
He's a great guy and a great forward. I mean, I think he got just three opportunities and he put it in. So he's great.
Were you surprised that you got the first PK? I mean, usually it's Thierry's.
I have to say thank you for that. I mean, he gave me that penalty.
What did he say to you right before they put the ball down?
Go ahead, buddy. Something like that. Just good luck.
Okay.
That was good.
Was it a good feeling that he had the confidence in you to take that shot?
Yeah, I mean, I think he did that because I was against my former team, you know.
Okay.
Can you explain what happened in the second half? The team game just kind of went kind of crazy. It just goals
mistakes,
everywhere.
A few mistakes. We had the game in control. And they are a great team, you know. They have a great touch on the ball. And I think we put ourselves in a position that, I mean, too many mistakes and then give up a goal. And that was what happened.
What does it say about the team to come back, obviously, late? You guys are down 3-2. It looks like it's over. And then you guys score twice to take out the result. What does it say about the team's character?
Strong. I think that was strong after at home, especially. We have to get 3 points here, so it was good.
I know it's your first year under Mike, but are there any similarities with Jason Kreis? Or is there any differences?
No. I think I said that before. This is different for me. I'm doing a different job here.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to get used to it.
And that is Fabian Espíndola. 6 goals in league play. He's got 8 in all competitions. Of course, the 2 goals he scored in the U.S. Open Cup against Reading United at Red Bull Arena in the 3rd round. And then the one that made it 1-1 over in Harvard against at the New England Revolution, which they lost, of course, in round 4 proper. But still, you just got to say, look, he's giving it his best shot. He's working hard. He's trying to fit into the system that Mike Petke's given him, into Petke's system. And right now it's, he is struggling. But you know what, though? I think he can do it. I think he can do well. And I just, you know, I think Fabian Espíndola is going to be pretty good and pretty strong. Thierry Henry. Now, obviously, we know how he is when it comes to how a match in this league can be. You know, you had control, you dominated the first half, and then all of a sudden you get to the 80th minute, and then you cough up 2 within 3, and then all of a sudden it looks like it fell apart. And he wanted to dominate from start to finish. You could tell he was a bit annoyed, trying to ask him good questions, try to get him to, you know, at least open up on what was going on. A little bit disgusted with how the match was in the second half. But once again, he said it was great effort to at least get the full 3 points. And, look, I don't blame Henry at all. I'm not one to blame anything about Henry. I think he's absolutely right because he brings in a true style of being a competitor. This is what you're trying to do in football. You want to fight for the 3 points, and you're going to have to go and tell the media how you feel. And, you know, he told us how he felt in a certain way, and I don't blame him. I don't blame him at all for feeling like that. So, hey, look, what are you going to do? Henri is right to react the way he does, and I don't blame him whatsoever. And here it is, Thierry Henri right now.
For France, Arsenal, Barcelona, have you ever been involved in anything crazy like that tonight?
Yes.
What goes through? What are your emotions at the end of the game? Just so many goals scored, so many swings of momentum at the end.
The only thing I'm going to say with that game tonight is great effort. That's it. Amazing effort.
Does it show something about the resiliency?
Yeah, great effort. We never gave up. We came back. Great effort.
What was the attitude at 3-3? It didn't look like the team was dropping back to settle for a title.
Well,
like you're pushing for the winner.
No, you knew like they came up with 5 minutes, so you know you have time to kind of win it. And Dax won it for us, so the place went mental. Happy with the win. It's the first time that personally I beat Salt Lake, and you know, team that stopped at the moment. So like I said to you, amazing effort, great effort. We come back into it, 3 points, happy.
Have you heard the stadium as loud as you did? At the end of that game?
Yeah, it's kind of weird, you know, you're kind of not realizing what just happened. But yeah, they were pretty loud.
Are you just exhausted or mentally exhausted?
No, great effort. That's exactly where I am right now.
But when it gets sold, it's obviously one of the best teams. What does that say about when your club stands out?
I don't have any doubt of how we play at home, but away from home, it's not the same team. So we have to manage our game away from home, play better. I know at home we're pretty good, but we have to play better away from home if we make the playoff, if we want to win this thing, because you know the games away from home are pretty important. We know we can play well at home, as we just shown, and even before that. But we have to play better away from home. I think that's the key right now to if we want to be a bit more consistent.
Is it more satisfaction on how you finish the game or disappointment on how you let them
think? Again, I'll go back to great effort. I'd rather to stay on that tonight. It's better, positive.
This entire week, obviously, Fabian Spindola and Jaime Snolave and even Johnny Steele, former RSL players, did you sense how much they, at least 1-3-1, they could get a tally tonight?
Johnny played the same way, running everywhere and fighting for everybody. SP did the same thing also, running everywhere, trying to make stuff happen for us, and Olave was brilliant at the back again. So I guess maybe if you had them, it must have been special for them. I'm happy for SP, he scored a double. But also for Dax. Dax needed to score, and especially a goal like that is going to give him a lot of confidence. But yeah, I guess it must have been more than special for him.
You know, did Salt Lake do anything in the second half to really change the game against you guys?
I'm going to say with great effort.
And you headed to Kansas City, another tough team, mm-hmm. on the road. Now you talk about going on the road and picking up points. Does this give you confidence, even though it is a home victory?
It is, but like I said earlier on, we know we're playing well. No disrespect to Toronto, but it's a place where maybe you expect us to win, and we didn't. So against Kansas City, it's a place where maybe you guys expect us to lose, so let's see what we can do there. It's another tough opponent, and especially at their place, you know, they don't concede a lot of goals, and they can hurt you at any time, so we're going to have to play well.
All right, guys, thank you.
And that is Thierry Henry on... Yeah, he's annoyed. Should have dominated from start to finish. But they had to make a comeback, and they had to go at it, and they did. They came back, and they got the 3 points, and now they got to go to Sporting Kansas City over at Sporting Park in Kansas City, Kansas. And, you know, got to get ready and got to do without Tim Cahill. So we'll see what happens as the Red Bulls try to overtake Sporting Kansas City. And obviously they want to get some revenge losing 1-0 earlier in the season against the same Sporting Kansas City side that, of course, got the only goal from Aurelien Cullen. And they're going to have to go out and try and do everything. Bradley Wright Phillips at the moment does not have his P1 visa currently. And it's just one of those things where you just got to say that it's it's just one of those moments that you know, you got to do everything possible. So, I mean, it's just got to keep on going, got to keep on trying, got to keep on fighting and try and get those 3 points on the road. Obviously, if they get a point, it's not that bad, but still, though, you'd like to see this team go out and be very consistent on the road. You know, and once again, you know, people talk to me and they say to me, how come all of a sudden they just don't look good on the road? How come all of a sudden they haven't done anything that they've done earlier in the season? Because, and really simple, when you you can definitely say this, that 3-week break in June hurt them. It basically just screwed them over. I'll say it. You know, they got a 3-week break, and unfortunately, sometimes, you know, certain teams can handle it and certain teams can't. Sporting Kansas City could handle it. The Red Bulls couldn't. And it's just one of those things that I just think that, you know, it just threw them for a loop. And unfortunately, that's the situation. That's all I can see, you know. They had an Open Cup match in between, but they lost it, unfortunately. And they had a strong lineup, too. So it's either MLS schedules people or teams, you know, either everyone gets a 3-week break or everyone doesn't get a three-week break. You know what I'm saying? It's just ridiculous. And, you know, it's just one of those things where I think the Red Bulls got hurt by it. And, you know, they need to be on a rhythm, and that's what it is. But hopefully they'll get back into a rhythm, and everything will get to be what it should be. Right now, I just think at the moment they're playing great at home. They got to do better at home. Obviously, this last home game was a little crazy. But exciting things happen at Red Bull Arena. There's nothing at Red Bull Arena that's going to be boring. You will always get something exciting happening at Red Bull Arena. And right now the Red Bulls are doing everything correctly. They're fantastic at home. They did a great job. And you know what? It's just one of those things where you definitely have to go out there and do wonderful things when you see your club play like that. And, you know, it's always the best when you are at Red Bull Arena. It doesn't matter where you are, okay? You want to come from Long Island, you want to come from Westchester County, Rockland County, you want to come from Orange County, New York, you want to come from the Bronx, from Brooklyn, from Queens, Staten Island, Manhattan, take over the path, take Jersey Transit to Newark, and then you take the path to Red Bull Arena. Go and do it. Go and do it. Come on over. Fill up that second deck. Do what you want to do. Come on over and see the real MLS side perform in a place. Yeah, New Jersey. So what? This is the New York City tri-state area. The Jets and the Giants play in New Jersey. The Nets have gone back and forth over the Hudson River too many times. They don't know where they want to be. Come on. Come on over. Come to Red Bull Arena on Saturday night, August 17th, against the Philadelphia Union. Come on over and see what this team can do, what they're all about. This is going to be awesome. I know it will be. Yeah, I can't wait. It's going to be great. It's going to be fantastic. I love it. Once again, as everyone already knows, Tim Cahill will be out 3 to 4 weeks with that PCL tear. Thankfully, does not need surgery. That's the best news out of the whole thing, even though he's going to be missing certain time, missing at least 3 to 4 matches in August. But definitely, you know he's going to try and cut that to 2 to 3 if he can. He'll probably try and go for the be back within 3 weeks. But definitely, guys, hopefully Tim Cahill will come back stronger, better than ever, and we'll see what happens. But obviously, it's going to be awesome. I know I cannot wait. And it's going to be fantastic. It's wonderful. And you know what? I cannot wait for it myself. So there you go. I cannot wait. It's going to be awesome. And just absolutely fantastic. Cannot wait. It's going to be great. So, once again, this is just absolutely breathtaking stuff over at Red Bull Arena. Once again, I want to update on some news here in Major League Soccer. The Columbus Crew no longer in the hands of the Hunt family. They sold it to a gentleman coming from San Francisco, a gentleman who runs his own business. And the place, of course, it's Precourt Sports Ventures, who purchased the Columbus Crew from Hunt Sports Group. The gentleman's name, of course, is Anthony Precourt. So it's named after his own name. It's named after himself. He's the managing partner of Precourt Sports Ventures, and he's also the new chairman of the Columbus Crew. The best thing about it is this, is that they are keeping the team in Columbus. I think that's, number one, a great thing, because you don't want to see this team as a charter member back in 1996. You don't want to see it move out of Columbus, of course. Lamar Hunt building the first ever soccer-specific stadium over there. We'll find out what's going to happen. But obviously this is a great moment if you're a Columbus Crew supporter to see that your side has now a brand new owner, and let's see what happens as the years go down. We'll have to wait and see. But once again, this is a fantastic day if you are a supporter of the Columbus Crew. And I also want to say it's been a great day to find out about this before the show got underway. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you want to find the Summer of 67 book, an e-book or a regular book, Amazon.com, you can order it as an e-book for your Kindle. You could also order the regular book through Amazon.com. It should be out in print. Check your local bookstore for it. The Summer of 67 by Ian Thompson. Just reading about it, just fantastic stuff going on about that book. And I have to say, very shocked to see that the Rooney family in Pittsburgh did get involved in the sport of soccer. And you wonder, maybe, don't know if it's possible, but if you're a Pittsburgh Riverhounds supporter, you would like to see if possibly maybe they get involved with the Riverhounds in some way. So you never know. Maybe there is a certain situation, but you got to say it's awesome to discuss. Once again, of course, if you followed my Gold Cup post-game shows, of course, our pre-game shows during the knockout stages, really simply, congratulations to Jurgen Klinsmann, his first CONCACAF Gold Cup championship, the fifth CONCACAF Gold Cup championship for the U.S. Soccer Federation. Congratulations, Landon Donovan, Breck Shea, Joe Corona, Eddie Johnson, Nick Raimondo, Sean Johnson, Clarence Goodson, and the rest of the team, pardon me, for winning the championship. Unfortunately, Stuart Holden, sadly, torn ACL in the right leg. That wasn't the leg that got into the tackle against the Panamanian defender. It was the left leg that was hit by the Panamanian defender. But unfortunately for Stuart Holden, he stepped wrong on the field, and he got that torn ACL. That's the report. I feel bad for Stuart Holden. And once again, it's another setback. But hopefully, for Stuart Holden, hopefully he'll get back on his feet and he'll show why he is an up-and-comer for the national team once again. Obviously, he was supposed to be part of the national team, but since that injury against Johnny Evans for Manchester United when he was playing for Bolton, Stu Holden, unfortunately, that's the first big setback. Now he's got this other setback, really sad thing. But other than that, ladies and gentlemen, I just have to say that this has been a great Gold Cup tournament. Jurgen Klinsmann has done a great job with the talent that is with the national team, and you have to say he has done a fantastic job with it, and I'm just very, very happy to see that there's a possibility maybe this upcoming World Cup, depending on when they qualify and if they do well getting a favorable draw, we'll see what happens with this team. I want to thank my guests tonight, Ian Thompson, the Soccer Observer. I also want to thank my panel for the North American Soccer League preview show. Once again, Neil Malone from Atlanta, Neil Morris from Carolina, Steve Sandor from Edmonton, Peter Brown in Fort Lauderdale, John Mathaler with Minnesota, Cesar Diaz, who covers the Cosmos now, James Hope from San Antonio, and Jake Sillick from Jacksonville/Tampa Bay for being on the show. My name is Daniel Feuerstein. Thank you very much for being with me tonight. I really appreciate your time. I really appreciate you guys listening in, covering American soccer here on the Feuerstein's Fire Internet Soccer Show. Join me next week, this coming Monday, on the Feuerstein's Fire Internet Soccer Show, and we're going to ratchet up once again CONCACAF Champions League group stage review shows. As always, please enjoy your football. Thank you. Have a good night, everybody, and talk to you on Monday. Bye-bye for now.